Hello everyone, welcome to the 8th episode of Tales from the Tea Room. Mm-hmm. We are back to tea because we went through some crazy episodes of having Tales from the Coffee Shop or Tales from the Prosecco Room. Mm-hmm. So now we are back to tea. We are having some, is it English breakfast or is it?
To be precise, Yorkshire tea. Mm. As a Yorkshireman, that's all I drink.
So that's the Yorkshire pride coming through.
Absolutely.
So it's March already, mm-hmm. and we have a special guest today.
Yes.
Aww. So we love having guests.
We love having guests. And this guest was more than welcome because he sort of read and listened to our broadcast and suggested he came over for a conversation. Mm-hmm. So we're going to welcome Brett Anderson.
Thank you very
today.
Much
Hi,
for
Brett.
Having me.
Brett's come over today from Glasgow. Brett, do you just want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I have recently submitted my PhD in human geography. I decided to come across today and talk to you a bit about that and mm-hmm. sort of hear your thoughts on it and sort of see where we go from there.
Great. So it's going to be a free-flowing conversation, really, just to hear a bit about Grant himself and his research, and we'll see where we go with it. But Edgar, do you want to sort of say, in terms of the themes we're looking at today, in terms of gender?
We are talking about gender nonconformity today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which seems very, very interesting. Mm. So I'm wondering if gender nonconformity is a little bit of an academic term. How would you say this in lay terms?
I think you're right. I think it does have an essence, maybe too much of being an academic sort of way of thinking about gender. And so when I was doing my PhD, I used it as an umbrella term to describe the numerous identities and expressions of gender that don't neatly fit into that sort of binary of male masculinity or women's femininity. And so it's part of that recruitment stage of the PhD when I was talking to participants, that was something that had to be explained. So it was academicizing that nonconformity or gender variance, but also having to think about new words and identities that were being used, like gender fluid or non-binary or agender. To sort of maybe make it more relevant to more popular discourses which mm-hmm. were going around at the time. And this is obviously a really shifting picture as well, because there are new words, new policies, new ways of thinking about gender that are coming and becoming more popular quite quickly, I think.
Absolutely. So for me, it's sort of playing with the male and playing with the female.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that could be done. Initially, I started to think about it in a sort of everyday terms. Mm-hmm. Sort of how we kind of police our own or police other people's masculinity and femininity. But then also thinking about it in sort of a community building way, mm-hmm. so looking at how that can be organised, how it's done purposefully or politically in different places, became sort of a secondary, sort of building on that individualism.
So if we start with Grant the person.
Oh no.
what brought you to this topic? What stirred your interest?
So I had done work with transgender people, like mm-hmm. binary trans male and trans female people as part of my undergrad dissertation. Mm-hmm. And then the more I started to think about non-binary identities, how they would work, how they fitted in or didn't fit into LGBT discourses, mm-hmm. I became more interested in that. And that was obviously something that was becoming more mainstream, mm-hmm. Something that was coming out in the news, different TV documentaries, and people were becoming increasingly aware of it. And then from a personal point of view, I'm from a village in Dumfries and Galloway, and I got this, as I became more comfortable with my gay life in Glasgow and mm-hmm. being surrounded by gay friends, when I would go home, I would feel more of a distance or a discomfort with mm-hmm. the way that I was behaving sort of in pubs mm-hmm. at home, sort of mm-hmm. in the middle of nowhere. And I thought about it, and originally I thought I was maybe had a bit of like gay shame, I suppose, or mm-hmm. gay baggage that I was taking back. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, oh, maybe actually, I mean, the people at home that were kind of making me feel apprehensive, and I'm not saying they were doing it intentionally, mm-hmm. it was an internal sort of discomfort as much mm-hmm. as anything else. The more I thought about it, I was like, oh, these people actually don't know who I'm having sex with. My sex life has nothing to do with them. Mm. My sexual orientation has nothing to do with them. Maybe it's actually like a gendered issue mm. that is more sort of a point of contestation. Mm-hmm. And then I started to think about it in terms of male femininity, mm-hmm. and sort of the discomforts that that might make other people feel, as well as myself, and sort of that using that as a point of difference sort of triggered that kind of way of thinking about gender nonconformity.
As you talk, Grant, my mind goes to performativity.
Uh-huh.
And I can imagine you in the bars of Glasgow performing a certain version of you that actually, you know, that's more possibly gender fluid.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm really feminine, but in comparison to those masculine spaces, there is that.
But it's all relative, isn't it? And then when you go back, because I'm from the Yorkshire Dales, very rural as well, so when I go back, there's that very more traditional binary view of what is masculine and what is feminine. And I can feel myself just having to revert and play a more masculine, take an interest in my car, which I don't do up here, you know, go DIY shopping, you know, for bits. And I don't know where that comes from, but it sounds like you've questioned that when you, what you were being asked to perform in both environments.
Yeah, so I think one of the most difficult things about talking about my PhD with people is that people, for the majority of people, this isn't an issue. This isn't something that they actively think about. And so I remember trying to explain my PhD to my mum and thinking about, like, how do I convince her that, like, there's more than these categories or these, like, tick boxes of man and woman. And the way I sort of explained it was, I behave very differently, not much more feminine, but definitely more feminine if I'm having a bottle of wine with my gay friends on a Friday night. We're much louder with each other, we're much more expressive, probably more tactile, more familiar with each other in that circumstance than when I am in different places. And because my PhD was in human geography, that sort of aspect of place and space and how we think about those conceptually and the way that we perform gender differently in different places became really important.
Now that you mentioned these qualities of being more tactile or being more expressive, I assume or I understand that you are referring to these qualities as feminine qualities, and that makes me question what is femininity or femininities, because I would be mindful of not essentializing femininity is this, because that would be troublesome for not only for gay men, but like what is so if a woman is not coming back to this pairing of female, therefore needs to be feminine, this alignment, and if it's not, if it's a woman who was born female and doesn't conform with those qualities, then I think my question is, would you contemplate various forms of femininity?
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand the way that masculinity or femininity are hegemonic, and that I think the point of distinction that I was feeling and that I was talking to people about was that rather than acting or performing in a specific way or adhering to specific stereotypes, it was that feeling of falling below the standards of how masculinity might be thought about in a particular place or femininity might be thought about in a particular place. And does that make more sense?
Yeah, and now that you mentioned the place, I wonder if did you see different gradients of femininity or masculinity moving in depending on the location or depending on the place?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. So just as a sort of background, the people that I sort of recruited as participants, they not only thought about gender expression, but they also identified in a way which wasn't binary in its ways of thinking. And so it was interesting to hear those, and they are quite everyday things about, like, I mean, we've all heard about the toilet problems and sort of that sort of architecturally building gender into the urban landscape. And also things like coming out to your family if you're gender non-conforming, and depending on who you're out on, you police your behaviour in different ways. So there were obvious things like families that were sort of a big issue, toilets, as I already mentioned. Going to, like, bars or cafes, from a Glasgow point of view, and there were certain places that were mentioned where people could not worry about the way that they express their gender. So, I mean, it was sort of those more regional or local geographies as well, and it was interesting to see how, or to hear how people sort of built up those, like, gender non-conforming maps in the place that they lived. of places that they would go and they would see as a safe space, and that could be quite close to a place that could be really problematic. Or
and that's what, when you were talking, Grant, I was thinking is, you know, when Edgar talks about, you know, thinking beyond the classic male, you know, masculine, feminine traits and problematizing what is feminine, what is masculine, I think the danger of that argument is that those can exist in quite academic bubbles and quite urban environments. And when we talk about geography, what you're talking about is quite a rural environment. And what I'm talking is quite a rural environment and quite a provincial environment where those discussions haven't yet reached. And so these are people's everyday experiences going back to environments where it is very entrenched in the discourse what is masculine and what is feminine.
I think you're right. We can all think very liberally about the way that the spectrum of masculinisms or the spectrum of feminisms, and it can be a rural environment, but it might not necessarily be a rural environment. I also don't want to draw that distinction or that binary between urban and rural, because I'm sure there are places in rural parts of Scotland.
And what I was saying was something different. There are many ways of being feminine and many ways of being masculine, regardless of where you live, and people might not refer to those terms. They might not even think about it, but if you, they just, by the way they live, by the way they are in the world, I mean, I'm sure that we could say something right now about, if we wanted to measure it or put ourselves into that spectrum, we could say what is, where we are, where the three of us in this spectrum of masculine, feminine.
Yeah, because I'm also thinking is, we're talking about, you know, when we're with other gay men and possibly when we're not with other gay men, when you go home, imagine you're the only gay man in your immediate environment. But then I was also thinking how gender and feminine masculine plays out within groups of gay men. And I'm thinking my own, when I'm with gay men who I'm not familiar with, I may portray more masculine traits because that's, in my own head, that seems what favoured.
Yeah.
But as you said, if I'm with my friends who I'm more familiar with and I'm drawing a glass of wine and it's a bit more relaxed, that's when, you know, I might use a feminine pronoun or, you know, more feminine traits. So even within groups of gay men, I don't like the term communities, but, you know, within pockets of gay men, it's played out in different senses. Did you have a feel for that?
I can't really reflect on that from a PhD point of view, but certainly from a personal point of view, I think femininity or a sort of a different form of masculinity, again, like what Edgar was saying, these are all relative terms, they're all stereotypes, and unfortunately I haven't been able to think of a way in which we can discuss this where you aren't resorting to stereotypes.
I think for me it's important we discuss what we experience, and for me, you know, spaces like Grindr, I experience a very hostile gendered environment, so I'm happy to use that language that I experience there, because I think it's important we discuss that as a way of then problematizing it.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that Twitter is full of sort of guttural opinions that people feel that they can express in any way they want, I think that Grindr can sometimes be another outlet in which femininity or, I mean, there's those kind of phrases like no femmes, no fads, no relations. And that's still a discourse that exists within like these online online platforms. And so, whereas I maybe painted a really positive picture about how comfortable I am surrounded by my gay friends, at the same time, within gay groups, gay communities, whatever language you want to use, there is that still judgment. In some cases, more of a judgment than what you might find out with them, because there's that sort of desire by some gay men to be as, like, danger quotes, normal as possible.
So for you, do you equate femininity with campness?
I don't know.
That's a question for both of you, really.
No, that would be, for me, that would be a no as an answer, because that would say, that would go back to the argument I'm trying to put forward, that there's no one way of saying this is what feminine is, what femininity is. And if you equate it with being camp, then you can do it, and that is a way of being feminine, but there are many other ways of being feminine. So that would say camp can be seen as some a way of of performing femininity, but there are many other ways. I often see, for example, this is, being camp is often a performance that relies on lots of classic, somehow anachronic ways of being feminine that many women don't use at all nowadays. Mm. You see women and I think there is a reason for some women not buying into that kind of gender norms that seem quite old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. And it's because, as if they are cisgender, they have that sense of, they might not think about it as I'm performing gender. Mm. They are just being what society has brought them to be.
But how's that then been assimilated into gay culture, gay discourses?
No, I think what gay discourses have assimilated is an old-fashioned way of being feminine. Mm. It's almost like women have evolved and they are performing lots of different new femininities, in my view, and the camp version of femininity seems like an outdated or a kind of
idolized, like maternal view almost, isn't it?
Yeah, like something, I mean, when I think of, an ideal of femininity of back from the 60s, 70s, something like that, and I wonder why that is, that gay men got caught somehow in that camp version of...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure why, as you said, that kind of campness got caught on and is still maybe present. I think originally campness was used sort of in films and things as a sort of a way of desexualizing the gay man, in the sense that you sort of remove the danger of their sexuality by sort of making a mockery of gayness and using femininity, unfortunately, as a way of
Femininity.
Yeah.
My mind goes to, I know Edgar and I have discussed this previously, the work of Alan Downes in The Velvet Rage. I don't know if you've read that book.
Yeah, Grant. I've
He talks that at a very early age, even at the age of 5 and 6, if there's a classic, you know, mother and father, there's a distance in between the father and the son, which the mother then picks up on, and the mother then comes in as a way to compensate for that. And so the gay boy feminizes himself to reinforce and to strengthen the mother-child relationship. He offers that as a way of understanding why campness has emerged as part of the gay culture. For listeners, Edgar is looking at me with a combination of disdain, confusion and rolling eyes.
I don't know if I'm doing the same.
I didn't roll my eyes. I read somewhere something that about a different explanation to what you are saying, that because cisgender women don't have to worry about performing femininity or womanhood because they are perceived or constructed as women already. There is some sort of fluidity on the way they can behave and challenge and evolve and bend gender rules. And I think it's the same for cisgender men. But when you want to perform something, it's almost like you have to rely on a theatrical way of making gender visible. And how do you make it visible? You need to rely on those quintessential, very
stereotypical
ways. Because if you don't, if we think of an example of that, of that gender performativity or gender like disruption, when you think of drag, of the art of drag, and you see how do you perform drag, how do you bend gender, you need to go through to an extreme of to make it.
I don't know if it necessarily always has to be resorting to an extreme. Did you say that you didn't think women need to think about being feminine, or men don't need to think about being masculine?
But they might be more relaxed about it if they are cisgender, because if that, I think that changes if you are a trans man or a trans woman.
Yeah.
It's a more intentional, very conscious, like, probably you are aware of that, of the minute details of your performance every single day.
I think there might be instances in which cisgendered men and women do actually have to think a lot about the way that they're presenting their gender. So maybe one example would be like women adopting more sort of stereotypical masculine sort of behaviours, maybe in a high octane work environment, or there might be a safety aspect of that, like a safeguarding technique. You make yourself, I mean, I do it as well. If you're walking down the street and you're the only person there and you sort of make yourself bigger and sort of take on those sort of behaviours. And I think that gay men, especially in a perceived response to, or a response to perceived homophobia, maybe act more masculine. And so I think there are sort of also minute everyday ways in which cisgendered people do take on sort of, whether it's for protection, whether it's to get authority over someone, whether it's to, like, and I mean, maybe to know more about this than I do, thinking about how, not just how we can be discriminated against because of the way that we perform gender, but also thinking about how we can use gender to our benefit. So if I was maybe wanting to strike more of a friendly rapport with someone in an interview, or when doing interviews or whatever, you sort of perform gender in a specific way in order, for your own benefit. I think we all have agency over our own, the way that we perform gender as well.
Yes, I agree with that. I agree. We all make conscious decisions about how to perform gender, and that goes regardless of whether you are cis or trans. And I think what I was trying to say is that if you align, if you have these three element alignment of being born male and you are and being masculine and also being heterosexual, which aligns gender and sexual aspect, like genitalia basically, and then the sexual orientation, then that is like kind of the three things. If you have, but if you have, if one of those is absent, if you are cisgender and very masculine, but you are gay, then that is a disruption of that. So it is, you might think about it more often than someone who is cis and also straight.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, so that's maybe thrown into sharper relief for someone that identifies as gay or a lesbian. So, but with those three different points, maybe it's interesting to think about it from the point of view of, you can be anatomically male, you can socially sort of identify as a man, and you're also assumed to like uphold sort of elements of masculinity as well in that. So that having those as the three points which shift, and when you shift too far away from those points, that's when you're sort of
That's the problem.
Judged.
When you
so you're all connected in a straight line, but the points move, and when they're disconnected too much, then that's what either triggers transphobia for trans people, or it triggers sort of genderism. So thinking about the ways that our gender is policed by other people, and we police our own gender presentation based on where we are to keep ourselves safe. Or
how do you think gender's played out amongst gay men? Because it was just saying there, this is the alignment, and then it feels like there is a wobble. We're allowed a bit of flexing, but actually there's a point where that the flexing isn't tolerated, or it's questioned, or it's problematized.
So if we think about that last point, that masculinity is sort of something that's
so
gay
almost
men pendulous.
Will play with that.
And
I've heard, you know, gay men, I've got feminine qualities and whatever, but there comes a point where that's all...
Yeah, where that becomes unacceptable as well,
What do you think that... those boundaries are, that space is there?
I don't know. At what point does male masculinity stretch
point,
too far?
I'm just trying to, you know, relate it back to the everyday, you know, in a gay bar or whatever that somebody is. Because I've worked with clients who are afraid to go to gay bars to perform that because the gay men turn against them.
Yeah.
It's too much, it's too extreme, that's not tolerated here. So is that...
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who wouldn't like to date gay men who were too feminine.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this time when he was in a relationship for, I think, a couple of years. They lived together with this guy who was apparently very feminine. And he was somehow challenged by other friends. He's like, oh, so what happens to your rule of not being in relationships or not dating too feminine, very feminine guys? And he said, well, but he's just very beautiful. So it's somehow that kind of element of beauty for him was something like, oh, okay, that overrides my previous rule of not. And I think that can be... We all can have many, many elements of... For him, it was beauty, but for some people, it might be... I mean, as simple things as how you connect with a person. Mm-hmm. Maybe you connect so much with that person that any performativity of gender that just becomes unimportant.
But I was trying to think, you know, there's a certain element, you know, femininity is accepted, but where does that theme on Grindr and other spaces come of no femmes? What's been... Masculine has been threatened by that.
So, okay, there are a couple of things happening in my head. First, Jason, I think that rather than talking about elements of homophobia and transphobia in these discussions, I think it's possibly more basic in that, in the fact that a lot of this discourse is sort of built upon sexist discourse, and if we think about it from the point of view that if we still, in that circumstance, we're still prioritising men, masculinity, as being as a higher level, as something to be achieved.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you fail that achievement, then it's a sort of discrimination against femininity, and that's sort of what sexism is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what the answer is to the boundary between that, but I think that's maybe a fundamental issue that gay men...
Something about being a patriarchy, because I guess gay men, and I thought of that, but it is men, isn't it, which is a patriarchal system.
And you'll be in a gay bar and it's made worse by the fact that 80 to 90% of the people there are men, and unfortunately, for a lot of gay men, that sort of patriarchy, that sort of hierarchy still exists for a lot of people. And then, Edgar, what you were saying about your friend, about how... this one guy, this feminine guy, sort of broke the rules for your friend. And so I haven't written about this, and so it's just something I've thought about for myself, not really discussed it all that much. But thinking about gay relationships and gay sex, how are they gendered? And is it someone's anatomical body that makes us gay, or is it the way that somebody performs the gender that decides whether we find them attractive or not?
I think sometimes the body determines a lot of what your perceived gender is, or how you might react to how people perceive you.
Mm.
I often think that in academia we talk about ideas and we talk about lots of different concepts and very abstract things, but then somehow the body gets forgotten, or as if we were disembodied creatures.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to refer back to the body and see how the body determines lots of different things. If I think of myself, I think it's somehow difficult to go outside of my history of performing masculinity. I like to acknowledge that I have some nice feminine traits or what could be classic feminine, stereotypical feminine things, and I love that, but sometimes I wish I could be more than that. So it is like that restriction of okay, so I can perform a little bit, but I shouldn't perform more than that, and that goes back to the body, and I think of my body and I think of my appearance, and I don't think that my body allows to have that full extent of feminine performativity. And I wonder how much that works for other people as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think you're right in saying that we forget about what our body's doing and when we're academicizing all these things. I wondered, like, from your perspective, or yours as well, Jason, what is it that restricts you? What puts those restrictions on that those feminine traits that you embody? We are all guilty of thinking about these things in academic ways, about ways that we can deconstruct gender and disrupt performativity. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's great, but I think one of the things from an awareness point of view is that just getting people to think more about gender.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have over the past 30 years thought a lot about sexuality and what that means to us and how that plays out in our everyday lives. So maybe it's time to start thinking about gender in similar ways.
Because one of the things Egg and I have a problem with is using gays as sexual orientation. Because we feel it's much more than just a sexual orientation. It impacts on so many other aspects of everyday life.
Yeah.
It almost feels like gender could be part of that conversation as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Gender is... I mean, you cannot take out gender of any aspect of living.
Yeah, I think I'm guilty sometimes. So I did transgender awareness training for a group earlier this week. And I think I'm guilty sometimes of just... how little people question gender, because it's never been they've never seen it as an issue for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, putting that into discourse is maybe something that's really important, and that needs to be driven sort of from a, I don't know, like a media point of view, like an everyday sort of encounter with other people. I'm not sure how you would do that.
Part of my research was how groups within the LGBT umbrella can have difficult conversations within themselves.
Mm.
And it feels like, because I was with somebody trans the other day, and they're back into the workplace, and they'd had somebody gone in and done trans awareness and, you know, getting the gender pronouns right. But actually, I've never seen those conversations within groups of gay men. How is gender played out, you know, within, how do you feel, you know, you perform massively?
Mm.
What is, you know, all the conversation we just had within the context of within groups of gay men. So that feels a really good space and a conversation to have, is it? The conversation we just had here.
I think they might, I think there might not be conversations so explicitly about gender, but I think in a way these conversations happen all the time and these decisions happen all the time. You've mentioned sometimes like what the type of clothes that you are going to wear, or how or what is appropriate in certain meetings, or what is not, depending on the audience. And I think those little acts are very, very important, because if you make those decisions and you make them consciously, then you are thinking about gender and you are bringing gender to the fore, and you are perhaps disrupting it, at least for yourself. And I think that is really, really good, because it might not have an effect on other people, but it might have an effect on you. And
And I think it's really, that was one thing that I noticed while doing my PhD research, was I've really started to think a lot about how I was doing, how I was doing my gender to other people when we were having these discussions. And so I sometimes do things like paint my nails. But then there might be an instance where, right, okay, I need to get rid of this now. Like, I'm going somewhere where I need to be, like, I'm going to an interview for a job, I need to behave in a certain way. Or And so I think you're right. I think that only through doing those tiny little things do we actually start to think about how... I mean, it's like political from a small P perspective, I suppose. Is it?
Yeah, because the personal is political.
Yeah, and so you're taking those personal choices, and you're making yourself visible. You are making, even if it's just a tiny little shuffle away from any kind of norm, like painting your nails in certain places or at certain times, is a political thing to do, because other people can see you. Other people, you are taking steps to actively distance yourself even a little bit from that norm.
And that is the everyday life.
Uh-huh.
That is,
yeah.
And I think our lives are made exactly by those little acts, those day-by-day activities that then can have a larger impact, but if they are amplified. And, but at least I think personal, I mean, those have personal importance.
Yeah, for sure. I actually... have seen, going back to a conversation we had before about Grindr, I have actually seen online conversations, and so I think Grindr started its own campaign against transphobia and racism.
So something around Kinda Grindr, was that?
Was that what it was called?
And I saw they were trying to launch that as a
yeah.
as an initiative somehow. I didn't read too much about it, but I understand.
Yeah, and so I think talking about those problems within gay communities, and that's sexism and racism and transphobia within gay communities, that's maybe one way to get to start having those conversations,
I suppose. Just thinking about that client I worked with who was very uncomfortable performing, getting, you know, putting nail varnish on and wearing in a bar. At that point, you know, he could have then spoken to the bar management and said, no, it's our policy. Do you know what I mean? Create more acceptance. As Edgar says, be accepting of those small acts of resistance that can be played in the different spaces online or in physical space as well. Mm-hmm. And actually more tolerance and understanding amongst ourselves where those resistances
are
being played.
Yeah, more understanding, yes.
I wonder, I mean, I'm not sure how often you do go to like gay bars or anything, but I wonder how much, so there's that kind of, in Western cities, there's that discourse where we're now in a post-gay bar world where we can just go everywhere because we've got acceptance everywhere, which obviously isn't true, but I wonder if there'll be like an almost renaissance of these spaces in the ways that we go on to be more inclusive of like queer people of colour or of transgender people or gender non-conforming people more widely, what a role these places are going to have in having these conversations.
Do you mean the dissolution of gay quarters in terms of because the need isn't there? Because
Edinburgh's a prime example, I think, of gay bars that have fallen by the way fallen by the wayside.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if.
And do you see that as a positive thing?
I don't know, but my question is: Are other people going to rely on these sort of community spaces or?
I think it's a discussion. It's probably a discussion for another podcast because I think the impact of online spaces emerging on these physical spaces is just being worked through. Because it's not just Edinburgh, you know, Manchester, a lot of them, the bars have been decimated because people are just not frequenting them.
Yeah.
So that's why some of them have taken the policy of diluting who goes in or broadening who's in because they need the revenue going in. So it's interesting what's been gained by not having those spaces, but also probably what's been lost.
Been lost, yeah.
And I don't know where that conversation goes.
You could go down a hole.
I've not seen the renaissances yet.
No.
But I think it's still too new. I think we're still working out if those spaces are being gone, what's been lost from a safe space, but, you know, a way to perform, you know, a shared experience.
I love the idea of a renaissance.
Be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I think there is so much to be cherished about gay culture and queer culture and LGBT culture that is that happened and happens in all those LGBTQ spaces, and I love that. It's because it's something that you can. They are unique spaces. They have no straight counterparts. If you go to a straight bar, it is a kind of you don't get the music, the performance there.
Yeah, I think maybe you inadvertently hit on a point I was trying to make about the difference between gay bars, and we can have a whole discussion about the problems of like gay bars and city centres and maybe a different time, but yeah, you also mentioned LGBTQ spaces, and so if we can think about the differences between those, and I suppose my question would be, how can those LGBTQ spaces rather than just gay spaces be used to be more inclusive, to adopt a more inclusive politics and to be more progressive in the way that gay men think about the LGBTQ acronym and everyone that falls under that umbrella.
I think that works at multi-level, but I think all that bar scene has a certain discourse to it, you know, starting with the flyers, even how the events, how, you know, it's a very hyper-masculine.
Yeah.
There's always a topless guy who's been to the gym on the flyers, isn't it? So it starts at that level, as you say, to the music that's been played, you know, and I've never been, certainly when I was in the game, it felt a very reinforced, stereotypical view. And it didn't feel LGBT.
Of masculinity.
It felt very G.
Yeah.
So
well, it's really interesting because in those two elements you mentioned, I think there is the topless guy at the bar, which is iconic of most gay bars.
I meant the flyers, even the flyers.
Oh, yeah, the flyers, yeah. and the music. So that kind of image of the topless guy seems to bring about that idea of masculinity, of classic masculinity. Yeah, yeah. And then when you listen to the music that is played, it is like, okay, the quintessential aspect of femininity. And so it is like all this tension between genders. So it's almost like, as gay men, we live in between narratives of what gender is or what gender. And I almost think that there is a very privileged way, privileged for sure. space to be, because we somehow have that that conscious decision of being, oh, well, I'm already here in this liminal space called gay bar with this hyper masculinity and this hyper femininity and then all these mixtures in between. And it's like,
yeah, I think that goes back to what you were saying right at the beginning as well. It's not just femininity, it's a very strong independent femininity that gayness wants to adopt and be associated with and power.
Because as you were talking, because my premise was, what can we learn?
Uh-huh.
But actually, people could learn from us.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So there's culture both sides.
Yeah. I think it got... Oh, it was really good.
It was what?
It was really good. I mean, the conversation.
Did you find it interesting?
I think so. Yeah.
It can be my practice, Viva.
Yeah.
I think you're right, though. I think... And then what you were saying before we started recording about, you just get so tied up in your own PhD that, I think I'm probably guilty of thinking about it in academic terms. So thinking about it, starting to think about that everyday, more embodied way of doing gender rather than just imaginary diagrams.
Yeah, I think about it for the listeners, but I also for myself. You have to go now.
You want a bus timetable?
No, I'll sort it out. Don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm. So what are you taking away, Grant? What's come up for you?
What am I thinking of? I think, for me, the most interesting part of this conversation has been thinking about those very potentially academic things that we were all discussing at the start, so thinking about performativity, thinking about these ways that we conceptualize gender in our heads, and linking that down to, as sort of all three of us have said, the way that we do that in our everyday lives, and the way we sort of check ourselves in certain places, the way that we can maybe express ourselves a bit more in other places, and also decentering or sort of deconstructing what masculinity and femininity is, and how best to think about that.
I think that's the same for me. I think you asked the question, what stops you?
Uh-huh.
And that's left me thinking, and I need time to process that and think about what does stop me expressing myself in different ways, not just in gendered ways, but maybe in a more authentic way, and what's been clipped by discourse over the years.
Yeah.
For you, Edgar?
Well, I like to think of the embodied ways that we can challenge gender, the little acts that I can think of, how can I use my body to challenge gender in some ways, and how can I blur that self-imposed, well, socially imposed and self-reinforced boundary of gender performativity for myself. So I think I have that task of being more, like, freer to express myself in a non-conformist way. I was to say genderless way, but I don't know how that would be.
Yeah, I don't know how you can become genderless. The only way to have, unfortunately, I think, unless one of you two can think of a different way to work with it. How would you think about all the discussions we've had today are within the confines of the stereotypes of masculinity and femininity? How do we get out of that? Or is it impossible? Do we just have to, like, work to...
I used to believe that was really difficult or impossible to escape that. But I think I've spoken about this before. I've met people who are impossible to decipher in those classic terms of femininity and masculinity and gender, and it's like I literally don't know how to categorize them in this binary. So they are, I think they embody exactly what gender fluidity or mm-hmm. non-binary means, because it was an episode, I think it was the third episode when I talked about it. I don't remember, but it was like this person who I still don't know their gender, because they are
what they identify as,
because they are just non-binary, and I feel that it's not really important to the relationship, to the type of relationship we have,
mm-hmm.
but that is a really eye-opening example for me of how it is possible to escape that gender binary.
Mm.
For me it seems challenging, but there are, the fact that there are people who do it successfully is really really great.
I was thinking, final thought, I was watching the Brits the other week. And even though it classes itself as, you know, diverse and you know, having ethnic diversity, everybody was still introduced as ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah. And we do these things with language all the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that's one thing that, I mean, it's a really simplistic thing to do, isn't it? Is to make things gender neutral, and especially language, because we do it all the time. But that's sort of where that right-wing media finds itself most relevant, is challenging
that.
Yeah, and that is a really simple act. I do that very consciously in every single event that I host. I always say hello everyone, or hello people, or hello because that phrase, that set phrase, the ladies and gentlemen, and it is so outdated.
I think so. I spent 4 months in Seattle as part of my PhD, and I was living with a trans and a non-binary person. They were super into their sort of queer lives, and so it was really interesting. I mean, the people that I was with and their friends all used gender neutral pronouns for everyone that they knew, unless they were told otherwise. And so it was really interesting to see that full conscious and very political flip and adoption of gender neutral terms, or this attitudes of being non-assumptive about someone's identity played out all the time, and that becoming normal.
Yeah, I really love that.
Yeah, it was really super interesting. Yeah,
yeah, and I think that is a very conscious exercise at the beginning, but then it becomes just natural.
Yeah,
I think we've had a couple of moments of tensions, you and I, Jason, when you've mentioned sometimes there was this time of the seminar, when the seminar at the university, the school, and you said 90% of the room was straight. And I said, we don't know. And you said, I can tell you, I'm sure they were, like 90% of them are straight. And I think, no, we don't know, because that is exactly that assumption, that if you don't challenge yourself with those assumptions, then it is like, how can you expect other people to change if you fall into those same assumptions?
On that bombshell. Shall we end there?
Yes.
Grant, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
thank you to our listeners.
Absolutely.
Following us and for listening to us. And
again, invite conversation, email us, follow us on Twitter. That's how Grant got in touch with us. So please, let us know what's come up for you in this conversation and ideas for other episodes. We'd love to have that conversation, and we'll see you in April.
See you in April.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.